Hello, everyone. Hello. Bonjour à tous. I'm Richard Levin, the Dean of the McGill Faculty of Medicine and Vice Principal for Health Affairs, and I take this opportunity to welcome you to a perennial homecoming favorite, Classes Without Quizzes. Now, this quack is, that wasn't quack, it was quack. This quack is ticking. It is so important and so oversubscribed that it is being simulcast on the web. And do we have the results? I thought this would happen. Ladies and gentlemen, this is an extraordinary announcement I have to make. At 4:02:12 Eastern Time this afternoon, we beat by, well, a small margin of 37 million, the previously recorded largest number of people watching a live broadcast which happened for the funeral of the Princess of Wales. Fantastic. 2,537,000,000 viewers are with us this afternoon watching this web broadcast. And it will be worth it. As you know, there are no papers or exams. What is required is that you simply sit back and enjoy this seminar entitled Healthy Body, Healthy Brain. And it is my great pleasure to introduce to you the director of the Montreal Neurological Institute, which is celebrating its 75th anniversary as the leading institute on the study of the brain in the world. Now, this gentleman has several characteristics that actually recommend him. Like me, he is a New Yorker. He began his scientific studies at the world-famous Bronx High School of Science. He received a degree, like me, from New York University, and he decided to migrate north to Montreal in 2002 to become the director of the Neuro, and now holds McGill's Penfield Chair in Neuroscience. In particular, he plays the banjo. It is a great pleasure on the 75th anniversary occasion to introduce my good friend, David Coleman.
So welcome. I'll give you a little bit of a background about the Neuro for those of you who don't know exactly what we do. So Penfield was also an American and who came up here because he saw great opportunity to do things that were different for his profession. Now, neurosurgery, he wrote 13 years before he came up here, in 1934 is when the Neuro opened its doors. So 13 years before that, he was a young guy, like Dr. Levin. And he wrote, and this is a quote, "Brain surgery is a terrible profession. If I did not feel that it will become different in my lifetime, I should hate it." Now, it was his sense of the intolerable standard of care for neurological patients at the time that drove him to conceive of a new hospital model, which is radically different from the hospital design conventions of that time. Now, then, and to an unfortunate extent even now, the design of hospitals is not driven by the needs of patients or clinicians or researchers, but rather by the preferences of administrators for structures that are easy to govern. At the time, Penfield first conceived of a research center, so he conceived of a large research center, and within that research center, you put a specialized neurological hospital. That was a new concept then, and it's still a concept which is considered new now, even though it's probably the best 21st century model for how to run a research institute with a hospital affiliated with it. What most places do is they have a big hospital, and then the research institutes are tacked around it, sort of like barnacles on a whale's tail. And that's not a model that works terribly well. It can work well, but it's not a recipe for success in the same way as having a big institute, and within it you put a specialized hospital that deals only with the problems that relate to what the institute is studying. So the Neuro is the largest medical center in the world, completely devoted to neurology, neurosurgery, and basic neuroscience as well. Over the past 75 years, we've made it our mission to push the boundaries of neurological science. We want to always be working at the frontier. In the 1930s, Penfield, along with his colleague Herbert Jasper, pioneered the legendary Montreal procedure for treating epilepsy. And that procedure, which we gave freely to the world, there's no patents, there's no, you know, no intellectual property that's preserved here, is treated thousands and thousands of patients and brought them back into a situation where they can go to work and they can have, you know, stay at home, live with their families. It has, I think, we've estimated it saved millions and millions of dollars all over the world once people have been treated by this procedure. During the Second World War, our doctors and researchers spearheaded improvements to the treatment of soldiers' head wounds. And a decade later, Dr. Brenda Milner initiated her groundbreaking studies that changed the way the world still thinks about memory and cognitive processes. By the mid-1970s, we'd begun to bring in critical brain imaging technology, introducing Canada to computerized axial tomography, or CAT scans, building Canada's first positron emission tomographic, or PET scanner, and producing the first PET images of stroke and brain tumors. In 1982, we were able, with the help from the McConnell Foundation here in Quebec, to purchase the first MRI scanner in the country. By 1994, statistics showed that the McGill University, in terms of neuroscience papers, they were cited more than any other group in any other university in Canada. And we've amassed a long list of achievements that have taken place at the Neuro throughout 75 years of existence. They each reflect different areas of neuroscience, but all spring from the same impetus that inspired Penfield decades ago, the sense that there must always be a better standard of care for our patients and a more precise means of understanding neurological conditions. Now, that brings me to three of my favorite faculty members who are sitting in the front here this afternoon, and you're going to hear from them. The first is Dr. Edith Hemmel, Leslie Fellows, and Wayne Sossam. Each is going to talk about their field for about 10 minutes, and we'll have a few questions after each presentation, and please just come up and use the microphone, and then we'll have a general discussion after that. So our first speaker is Dr. Hemmel. She and her colleagues study how neurons and glial cells influence the brain's blood supply. So neurons are nerve cells. Glial cells are the cells which support and nurture those nerve cells throughout your life. Because problems with specific populations of cells may have dramatic repercussions on the brain's ability to regulate blood flow, Dr. Hemmel seeks to understand how brain neurons control cerebral flow and how their work is altered by conditions such as Alzheimer's disease and migraine headache. Her lab hopes to understand the effects of Alzheimer's disease in particular so that new drugs can be developed to preserve normal blood supply in the brain in spite of the dysfunction which is brought about by that disease. But Dr. Hemmel.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Coleman. Welcome. It's a pleasure to be here this afternoon. And I will try to talk about what we do in the lab. So it's a lab of basic research that I'm running at the MNI. I have the privilege of being there and sharing a discussion with clinicians, but basically what we do is really basic research. So what I'd like to talk about today is Alzheimer's disease, but from the point of view of the research we do and from the point of view of the cerebral circulation, which I think is a different angle from what is being done in most of the research lab. So you may know, and if you do not know, Alzheimer's disease is the most common form of dementia from all the dementia that are being diagnosed today. It accounts for more than 60% of them. It appears in two forms. A very rare form, which comes in less than 5%, is the familial genetic form of Alzheimer's disease, which account, as I said, for less than 5% of the Alzheimer's disease patient. Most of the Alzheimer's disease that we have or that we see are people who suffer from the sporadic form of Alzheimer's disease, which is likely to be, for most of us who suffer, if we do suffer from Alzheimer's disease, the form that we will be suffering from. And the major risk factor is aging. So this is really a disease of aging. When it was first described by Dr. Alzheimer himself, when he had his patient, Auguste Dieter, in 1906, he described it as obviously a disease where memory is being deteriorating, it's memory loss. And then actually he performed a neuropathological exam where he described the main landmarks of the disease when you look at the brain of the patient, which is the appearance of plaques. So you have plaques within the brain tissue that accumulates, and those plaques contain a peptide which is called amyloid beta peptide. There is also what is referred to as neurofibrillary tangle, which are actually also appearing in the neurons of these patients. There is also at the end of the pathology, when you look at the brain is slightly smaller in those patients because neurons have been lost and the brain has been a little bit basically suffering from that. But also something very interesting that was described at the time was that there is a vascular pathology in Alzheimer's disease, which also is predominant. And when we talk about a vascular pathology, why would that be important? As Dr. Coleman said, the brain is actually your neuron, which makes you behave and think and react. But they need to be fed by oxygen, by their nutrients, by glucose, basically, that they use as their fuel to be able to do their function. And this is being brought to them by the blood vessels of the brain. And as you can see here, how dramatically intense and concentrated are those blood vessels. This is actually a cast of a human brain, so you can see all the vessels going into the brain to feed the neurons. So it's very intense, very, very densely irrigated. What is interesting is that in Alzheimer's disease patients, those vessels are actually, they're sick. They do not look like the vessels in an aged, normal human brain. So as you can see in the top, you have very nice and smooth vessels. Even though in a 90-year-old patient that died not from Alzheimer's disease, the vessel will be nice and smooth. In the brain of AD patient, they are ragged. There is vacuoles, they are damaged. So the surface, the structure, basically, of the vessel themselves is damaged in that disease. Even more than that, they actually secrete proteins that make their wall become thicker. As you can see here, the wall of the vessel is thickened in Alzheimer's disease. And they accumulate this famous peptide of amyloid beta that we said was accumulating in the brain. They also actually accumulate this peptide around their wall. And they are actually important in clearing the brain from this peptide. This is how the peptide normally gets out of the brain, is through clearance pathway, through receptors that are located within these vessels. So if the vessels do not work well, obviously you may have a pathology. And I think what is interesting is that for the sporadic form of Alzheimer's disease that develops in the 70s, mid-70s, the main risk factor is aging, as is well known. But a lot of other factors actually are related to vascular diseases, as I've listed here a couple of those, hypertension, hypercholesterolemia, heart disease, ischemic stroke. So all of these actually will target the blood vessel. And what will happen is that they may actually have less blood supply to the brain, which may end up having also other consequences on the functioning of the brain. So for some people who really believe in that 200%, they would say that Alzheimer's disease is a vascular disease, which I do not share. I don't think it is clearly only a vascular disease, but it is an important component of the disease. So if we look at that as a gross thing as an overall pathology to study, we have a vascular pathology that we can study. We have the amyloid peptide that is accumulating, that all together will interact to eventually lead to cognitive deficit, to neuronal dysfunction. And how can we then in the lab try to normalize those blood vessels that are sick and try to normalize memory? Is there a way that we can actually study that will be meaningful for the human condition? So I just want to show you this slide, but forget it right away. It's just to tell you that basically lots of work is being done. And very recently, there has been molecular work that is telling us that basically a sick brain or a brain that doesn't get its blood supply as it should, that doesn't get the oxygen that it should get, actually result, as shown here, in the accumulation of amyloid beta. So the brain doesn't clear the amyloid beta as it should. So the peptide accumulates in the brain, and there is also a decreased perfusion. So your brain doesn't have as much perfusion as it should get. So if we study then, if we believe that those two aspects are important in the disease, that you don't have as much blood supply as you should have, and that the peptide is accumulating because it's not being cleared as it should be, and that has effect on your behavior, on the memory, how can we study that in a lab where hopefully it will have effect and we can eventually lead to new development for the therapy of those diseases? Well, we use mouse model that actually mimic the pathology of the Alzheimer's disease. Many of those exist, and they come from different sources, different ways that they've been done. One of them, which is used very broadly, is where we've taken the genes of those genetic form of Alzheimer's disease, and we've put them in mouse. So those mice then have the amyloid beta peptide pathology, they have the loss of memory, they have an hypoperfusion, so cerebral hypoperfusion, they have loss of vascular reactivity. So basically they mimic very well the pathology that we see in the human, including most importantly the memory deficit. So how can we then try to normalize all of these in mouse? And is that possible to do so? Considering that it's a disease of aging, it means we have to have the animal age quite a lot so that we can see this symptom appear. And then what can we do? So basically, I'm going to summarize some story that we've done in the lab where we've tried to restore the vascular function. And without telling you the molecules that we've used, the medication that we've used, I'm just going to tell you we've tested compounds that are used in the treatment of cardiovascular disease, either hypertension, hypercholesterolemia, or the vascular problem that appear in diabetes, for instance. And what I can show you is that, yes, in animals that do show a deficit in perfusion, as shown here, if you treat them, you can normalize that perfusion. In blood vessels from these animals that do not dilate properly, if you treat them, yes, you can restore dilatation. So overall, it was in our hand, very, not easy, but quite easy, I would say, with a lot of compounds that we tested that had cardiovascular effect because they were used to treat cardiovascular diseases, they were actually quite able to restore function of the vessel. But what we noticed that was not rescued was the structure. So even though the vessels were responding well, they were still altered, they were still ragged, they were still damaged. But in a way, we said, yes, maybe the vessels are not becoming young like they were when we were 25 years old, but they work. We were able to restore the signaling molecule, the synthesis of the pathway that make the vessel dilate, good enough to make them work properly, which we believe is probably the most important thing, even though they may not be nice and smooth. They are able to work properly. Then, what about memory? Is it possible actually to measure memory and to restore memory when we work with laboratory animals, with those animal models of Alzheimer's disease? The most common form of we can study memory in mouse models of Alzheimer's disease is actually to test their memory to try to find a platform. So we put them in a pool and they love swimming. Actually, they love it. Sometimes they will just stay there and float if the water is too warm. But what we do, we put them in the pool and we hide the platform. And we train them to remember where is that hidden platform. So as you can see on the first day, they really circle around in the pool trying to find this platform. After the fifth day of training, the normal mice, right away, they will go right through that platform and they will get out of the water. So they actually know very well what has to be done. So then, what happens to our animal models of Alzheimer's disease? So here is basically what we do. So we test them for 3 days with a visible platform. So we can eliminate the mice that do not see well, do not swim well, have motor problem. So those first 3 days are really there to tell us 1, 2, 3. If at the third day they are not similar between the wild type, which is the control, and the APP, which is the sick mouse, then we eliminate them. Then we play a trick on them. The fourth day, we move the platform in a different place in the pool, and then we put them back in the pool so they have to find this newly located platform, which is now hidden. That one they do not see. And as you can see in the green curve, the 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, the fourth day they're a little bit disorganized because they don't know where is the platform. But the 5, 6, 7, 8, they really go right away on that platform. The blue line, as you can see, the mice, they don't really know where it is, the blue line. But the fourth line in green now, we've treated the wild-type mice with an anti-hypertensive compound, and you can see the wild mice, they know exactly where it is, and that doesn't change whether you treat them or not. But look at these old mice. The red line now were Alzheimer's disease mice that basically were about 18 months old, and now we've been treating them, and they behave much similarly, like the non-sick animal. So clearly telling us, yes, even in those sick animals, there is something we can do and we can actually rescue memory. Will that, what does it mean? Will they remember, actually, the test? So now if I remove the platform and put them back at the pool, will they know where the platform is located? A normal mouse will do that. So the black dot just tells you where was the platform. There is no more platform. So now we put them back and we see, will they remember where was located the platform? A normal mouse does that. It goes right away where was the platform. In Alzheimer's mouse, as you can see here, travels in the pool, the white line, it travels in the pool basically everywhere, but does not really find the platform unless by luck sometime we may get to it. But it just circles. If we treat the Alzheimer's mice with those compounds, look at that. Those mice know exactly. They remember exactly where was the platform. They traveled in that quadrant saying, hey, the platform was there. Give me some time. I'm going to find it. So they have actually remembered where the platform was located. How long does that last? We've tested old mice in finishing for just after 2 days, 2 hours I'm showing here. So 2 hours after, you know, we remove the platform, they remember. In the red panel here, you see very well that they remember where is the platform. 2 days later, again, in the red, they remember very well where is the platform. And we went up to 3 weeks in these animals, and they still remember very well where is the platform. And with younger animals, we went up to 6 and 8 weeks, and they remember very well where is the platform. So basically, I think it has been suggested that one of an easy way or an interesting way to look at Alzheimer's disease patients to help them will be to restore the brain perfusion so that that aggravating factor to the loss of neuron or to the fact that neurons do not go well could actually help and retard the pathology that is underlying. And our data, I would say, really would suggest that it is, first of all, very possible to restore perfusion to the brain. I think a lot of compounds that we tested were able to do that. However, not all of those that rescue blood flow rescued memory. So we have to understand what makes a compound able to rescue both the perfusion to the brain as well as the memory. There is a link, but it may not be 100% linked all the time. So in closing, I'd like to thank really all the people who work with me at the MNI, all of the students, the postdoctoral fellow, and I would like to mention some of the yellow one are the one who really work on Alzheimer's disease, and I'd like to thank you for your attention. Thank you very much.
We can take a couple of questions if you have for Dr. Hernal, and then we'll have a general discussion.
Yes, there is a question there. Yes.
Come to the microphone in the middle, please.
There are some researchers who argue that the so-called diseases of old age are not inevitable, but rather are the later stages of conditions that have been previously neglected. As a related thing, there is evidence to suggest that women who are pregnant and do not get proper nutrition produce permanently damaged babies that are susceptible to early onset of these diseases many years later on. So the question I'm asking is, what does your research have to say about, in effect, prevention in order to try to delay the inevitability of these later stages, particularly if you're talking about structural damage?
Yes, I think that's a very good question. And as we're trying to do in the community now more and more is to treat the diseases, diabetes, hypertension, hypercholesterolemia, all of the disease that we know may affect later on, have an impact on the cognitive function of the people. So it is clearly, I think, if patients are not treated properly, they will become aggravating factor to a brain who is aging, which is aging and which is losing some of its capacity, even though it is still able to function properly. Those are aggravating factor that at some point, if they're not treated, can really culminate, and then the disease will express itself. So I think it's the prevention and the treatment is very important. For what you mentioned about the baby, you know, the baby and the mom, we have to be very careful. Alzheimer's disease so far, the form that occurs very early on in the mid-40s is clearly a genetic disease. The genes have been identified in family, and it has nothing to do basically with the status of the pregnancy or the fetus. Those are genes, they're transmitted in healthy babies as much as in non-healthy babies. But those represent probably, as we agree today, clearly less than 5% of all the Alzheimer's disease patients.
I'll just try to clarify and then I'll stop. No, but the evidence does show that children born at times because of famine or drugs or other things, where the parents were malnourished, do get heart conditions and Alzheimer's and other diseases much earlier
yes.
than most other people. So it would suggest that there is this strong component.
Those are sick from day one. In a way, they are not developing normally, so they have an intrinsic pathology that may express maybe differently.
Next question.
Yes.
Yes, I'm just wondering, is there a certain class of hypotensors that you've found that works better than others?
Well, you know, I didn't want to go into the details of the compound. Many compounds are being tested from the families of hypertensive anti-hypercholesterolemic agent. And so far, a lot of the compounds that have been tested have been successful in some animal models. And some have been tested in clinical trials as well. Some of these molecular or epidemiological studies have been done. And normally it's a family of compound. It is not necessarily a given compound. It is a family of compound. And at this point, we have to know where they act exactly. What I think is coming through, they don't have a single site of action. They probably have multiple sites of action. And that may be explaining why they have this capacity to act at multiple levels. So I think at this point, it's multiple class of compound.
Oh, different classes. I'm just wondering if we know it works, why not use it and then figure out why?
Well, I mean, those studies, actually, the medication we've taken were those that people were using. You know, they are used clinically in anti-hypertensive patients, and they had been shown in some epidemiological studies that those patients treated with this type of compound had less incidence of Alzheimer's disease. But those were, as I say, they were not very multi-center and worldwide studies with so many thousands of patients. But there are a lot of medication used today by people with diabetes, hypertension, that are actually heading to be important molecule to test with. Yes.
Thanks. That's all we have time for now. We'll come back in the general discussion. You can ask the other questions. Thank you very much. Our next speaker is Dr. Leslie Fellows, who's a neurologist who specializes in disorders of cognition, takes particular interest in the functions of the brain's frontal lobes. Her research uses the techniques of cognitive neuroscience to study the decision-making process in the human brain. As well, she's interested in more general questions about the roles that the frontal lobes play in the regulation of emotion, the expression of personality traits, and the representation of past and future information. Dr. Fellows.
So, one moment. First test. Great. Okay. Thank you for having me. This general topic is a topic that I know is dear to many people's hearts and is, of public health importance. And mention was made in my research interests. I am also a cognitive behavioral neurologist, and so my clinical work is with people with memory difficulties, among other things. And I decided to focus my talk today a little less on research that I do, which is maybe not that directly relevant to these issues that are being discussed by the other two speakers, and a little more on the kinds of questions I get in my clinic. So the title of the talk I've chosen here is Hold That Thought, What Leads to Cognitive Decline with Age and Is It Inevitable? So really addressing the question that was just asked a few minutes ago. So the first thing is that when people think about cognitive aging or changes in the brain with age, the thing that neurologists spend their time doing is trying to figure out what's the normal change with age? Are there normal changes with age? And if so, what are they? And then what are the illnesses that are common with age that affect thinking? And basically, there's two ways to think about those illnesses. One is what I would call a syndromic way of describing what's wrong. It's not really getting you any further, in a way, but it's giving you kind of an official name to apply to a person's complaints. It's not a diagnosis, it's just a description. And so we have two terms that we use. One is called mild cognitive impairment, and that refers to people who have definable changes in cognition, usually in one part of area of cognition only, that's not substantially affecting their function. And then we have a term, dementia, which just means progressive difficulties in two domains, at least, of cognition that are affecting function. And that's basically that. But that doesn't say what the cause is. It does say that there's something wrong that we consider outside the range of normal. And then the causes are basically divided into reversible causes, which are rare but very important to identify, obviously, and then either static conditions or progressive conditions, with the last being the most common. And amongst the progressive conditions that can give you mild cognitive impairment and then dementia, there's Alzheimer's dementia, as Dr. Amel said, the most common diagnosis. And the next most common diagnosis is something called vascular dementia, which refers to the circulation of the brain. And it's a kind of a grab bag of conditions that include people who have had, for example, a large stroke. That's a vascular condition. And if that large stroke affects parts of the brain that are important for memory, speaking, or what have you, then by definition people can acquire dementia just on the basis of a single stroke if that stroke happens to affect the parts of the brain that are critical for cognition. Or you can have multiple strokes, small strokes in various parts of the brain that will gradually erode cognition, and that's also vascular dementia. And the area that's been among the most interesting in recent years in terms of the clinical thinking about dementia has been around the interaction between Alzheimer's disease and vascular disease, and is it just that you have you're accumulating brain injury from two different sources? So on the one hand, you're losing brain to small strokes, and on the other hand, you're losing brain to Alzheimer's pathology, or do the two actually interact with each other? And if so, which is coming first? Are they in some kind of a vicious cycle? And these are very interesting research questions, but they have very immediate clinical importance. So before I turn to those issues, I want to talk about whether cognitive decline with age is inevitable. And the answer is yes, kind of. So what I'm showing you here is from a large study of thousands of people, healthy people, across a wide range of ages. But if you look and see, I'm trying to get the mouse here, the range of ages they're reporting here are just about 21 or so to 60. So you see in what you would think of as probably maybe the age group that you're not thinking about memory changes, in all kinds of different kinds of memory testing, that memory is gradually getting worse with age. And so is reasoning, and so is spatial ability, and so is reaction time. So pretty much any of the constructs that we measure routinely in humans in terms of cognition tend to gradually get worse with age. But they're declining from 25, which is, I guess, food for thought. But it's not what people think of when they think of brain aging. It's changes that are happening very early. And this isn't people who we believe to be healthy. I don't think it's true that everything gets worse with age. Wisdom, I suspect, improves with age. And probably expertise-based decision-making improves with age and experience. So we just don't tend to measure those. Maybe because neuropsychologists are young, I'm not sure. But anyway, so there are changes with age that we have to imagine are normal changes, especially these changes that are happening very early in adult life, are unlikely to relate to brain pathology. But you don't have to take my word for it, because even though this is a class without quizzes, I'm going to put you to work. Whoops, not quite so fast. I'm going to ask you to do a little experiment for me, briefly. So I'm going to show you pictures, words, just like you just saw. A word is going to appear on the screen. I want you to, as quickly as possible, shout out the color of ink that the word is written in. So your job is to say the color of ink as fast as you can, with confidence, to be the first in your row to shout the color of ink. Here we go. Get ready. Okay, faster than that, come on, you guys.
Green.
You're doing pretty well.
Blue. Green.
Aha. Okay. So, that's pretty good. I guess you're not all McGill grads, is that? So that's a famous test called the Stroop test that gets at the fact that most of what we do, actually, most of our brain function in normal life is actually quite routine and habitual, and it's easy to choose the response because there's only one response to choose. But there are circumstances, like the one you just experienced, where there are two competing responses, and you have to suppress the most common response in order to make the correct response, and that takes a lot of brain power. And that's an example of the kind of testing that might be done to give those curves I just showed you earlier. And I'm not actually showing you data from that particular task, but another similar task. This is from my own lab, looking again at the effects of age on performance. And you can see that here, in this case, we're showing errors. So the higher it goes, the worse your performance. And you can see that with age, there's a tendency for performance to worsen, just like I showed you before, between 20 and 70 or so. But what's more interesting about this graph, I think, is that with age, the variability gets bigger and bigger. So some people at 70 are performing as well as some people at 20, and some people are really not performing well at all. So yes, there's a trend for age to be associated with poor cognitive function, but there's also clear evidence that the variability goes up. And so with that, there's always the hope that you're going to be here, right, and not here. But then the question is, well, what's the difference between this person and this person? What's happening here? You can see the same thing when you look at the brain, the physical brain, that these are MRI scans that I borrowed from Natasha Raja, who's a McGill researcher who studies aging. This is just to show these are healthy volunteers. And this is just to show that there's a very wide range of what the brain looks like with age. So this is a young brain. This is in one section. These are other ways of sectioning with an MRI scan. But what I want you to look at is kind of the juiciness, the plumpness of these brains. And you can have one old subject here. They're all about the same age. Another one here, another here. And if you compare this person's, the degree of sort of shrinkage of the brain to this person's, even though they're the same age, this person has quite a bit less brain volume, bigger ventricles. The black parts are just the fluid around the brain. And this person looks really similar to the young person. And again, there's a wide variability. And we're not sure. This is in healthy people, as far as we know. We're not sure what explains that. And then with the advent of MRI imaging, we've started to be able to see the brain in a lot of detail, and in fact in so much detail that we're not sure what we're looking at. So one of the things that people started to recognize in MR imaging of healthy people that especially accumulates with age are these sort of little white spots around the edge of the ventricles here called periventricular. This stuff here and here, and you see it again over in another person's brain here. These people are in their 60s, they're healthy. These are white matter changes that are of unclear, initially were of unclear etiology. They're not strokes. They seem to be some kind of chronic change in the microcirculation of the brain that leads to these sort of gradual scarring and loss of brain tissue and these susceptible areas of the white matter. And that, too, varies widely in apparently healthy people. So how do we make sense of this? So first of all, many cognitive abilities do decrease with age, and the structure of the brain tends to change with age. But there's variability in these changes. The variability itself increases with age. Dementia, frank dementia, it's become very clear now, has a preclinical stage that lasts for several years, possibly a decade or more than a decade. Before it's clinically evident, before it's evident even to the person or to the family, now that we're starting to be able to look into the living brain in various ways, we can see that Alzheimer's pathology, for example, is already present in the people who will eventually have dementia many years before that will happen. So the big challenge clinically is to how to distinguish normal changes with age from the very earliest signs of dementia, because if we're going to intervene, we would like to do it early, before the dementia is there. So that's the big challenge. I'm not actually going to tell you what I said. I guess what I can tell you is that that's the big challenge. Have we done it yet? No. We can sort of, as we often do in medicine, say, well, we'll work on that. But meanwhile, can anything be done to prevent dementia? And to do that, you can not necessarily understand exactly the causes, but instead just look for associations in population studies. You can go and ask what's going on with people. Are they, what is it that might protect against dementia? What's present in people who get dementia and what's not? And based on that kind of study, you can there are clear, well-defined risk factors for dementia. So age is the number one risk factor, but it's a difficult thing to get around. But there are modifiable risk factors that are clearly associated with increased chance of getting dementia. There's smoking cigarettes, having high blood pressure, having diabetes, high cholesterol, and obesity. And there are pretty relatively good evidence to suggest there are protective factors. And higher education is actually one of them. And there's no specific evidence that a McGill degree is better, but there's some suggestion. But it's the case that higher education, which actually means more than 10 years of education in a lot of these studies, that being physically active, doing mentally demanding work, being in a more powerful position in society, having stimulating leisure activities, living in a couple, and being involved in a rich social network, that these are protective factors. And I want this is the one real content slide. This is the, you know, I assume this audience is able to think critically about things, and so you should think critically about what you read about dementia because it's a kind of an emotional issue, and people grab on to ideas about what puts them at risk or what might protect them. One of the main problems with these kinds of studies is they're based on observations of populations, so it can be hard to tell whether what you're seeing is an association that's just sort of a coincidence that may not actually mean anything about causality, or is it a true causal thing? So is high blood pressure causing dementia, or is it just an association? Is there something else that happens to cause high blood pressure and dementia, for example? And one of the other problems with dementia in particular is sorting out causation compared to reverse causation. For example, many of the studies that have looked at, for example, social networks and things like that, look at it just a few years before the person becomes demented. And it's hard to know it was the reason the person didn't have very many friends because they were already having cognitive difficulties and withdrawing. Or is it because they didn't have enough friends that they were at some extra risk for dementia and that's why they developed it so soon after? So that can be very difficult to tease out. And one way to tease that out is to go back a long way back. And there's some very good work coming from Finland, and I'll show you in a second, that looks at people when they're in their 50s or their 40s and then 20 or 30 years later to try to figure out what's protecting them or putting them at risk for dementia over that kind of a time frame. The last thing that you should ask yourself when you read articles about this kind of thing in the newspaper is, what's the effect size? So how important are these risk factors? Do they increase my risk by 1% or 100%? If you're going to make some major change in your life or take up Sudoku or whatever, you want to know if that's going to reduce your risk by a teeny tiny fraction or by a major amount before you make changes. The strongest evidence we would like to have is not from observation but from intervention, where you actually make a change. You take a medication and you give it to people and you see whether their dementia risk is less. But that's a very that's not easy to do, especially with dementia, which takes years to proclaim itself. And we don't have much good evidence about that yet. So I just want to tell you about this, the data from this Finnish study, because I think it's very informative about what you can do personally, potentially, to reduce your risk of dementia. So they followed for almost 1,500 Finns from age 50 to 70. And over those 20 years, 4% of that group developed dementia, and another 4% developed mild cognitive impairment. And I think that's really important to put this into context. 92% of the group they were studying very carefully did not have cognitive difficulties at the age of 70 or 71. Okay? So it's only, even though dementia is common, most people don't get it. They were able to figure out what the risk factors were, and I'm going to show you an example of their lowest risk kind of group and their highest risk group to give you a sense of scale. So the lowest risk group was someone who was younger than 47 at the time they were first enrolled in the study, a woman with more than 10 years of education, normal blood pressure, not fat, no normal cholesterol, physically active, and no genetic risk factor. And her risk of developing dementia 20 years later is less than, well, it's 0.1%, so about 1 in 1,000. of people in that general group will get dementia 20 years later, compared to someone who was more than 53 at the time they were enrolled, male, less than 6 years of education, high blood pressure, obese, all the risk factors. Their risk of dementia was close to 50%, so 1 in 2 versus 1 in 800. So that gives you some idea, if you put enough of those risk factors together, of the scope of these kinds of things. So here's kind of the take-home summary. Each of these individual risk factors, this is how much it changed the person's risk. So, for example, men compared to women had 1.6 times higher risk. I guess people who are male at midlife are probably still male in old age. Low education here, less than 6 years of education compared to more than 10 years of education, 3.5 times more likely. So you can see the relative sort of scope of that kind of thing. And that most of the vascular risk factors about double the risk individually. But obviously if you add several of those together, that increases more. So the take-home message is that both cognition and brain structure do change with age, but the degree of change varies widely. Part of that variability with age is probably the fact that some of the population is developing very early pathology. So some of that normal, healthy group probably does have very early dementia, and that may be partly why their performance is starting to skew so widely. And some of it relates to the fact that there's definable vascular changes, small strokes, for example, that are happening to people who may not be aware of it. So that can accumulate and slow people down as well. And there is this interesting interaction between vascular disease and Alzheimer's that's still being studied, but it appears to be important both from the basic research point of view and from the study of populations. So dementia prevention may be possible, but you have to do it probably in midlife at the latest, because that's the point where you're relatively sure that you're getting there before the pathological changes are starting. So what can you actually do? The main thing that I want you to take home is that you can modify what are called modifiable vascular risk factors. You can stop smoking, you can lose weight, you can treat your blood pressure. That's important. That counts for quite a bit in dementia prevention. You could lead a stimulating and socially engaged life, which I would actually recommend, even if you're not worrying about dementia. You could support a strong education system and an egalitarian social structure that promotes healthy eating and exercise on the theory that prevention probably has to start before midlife, and that if we're worrying about dementia now, given the way obesity is happening in children, in the current generation of children, we're going to have really big problems with dementia in 60 or 70 years. The last thing, though, is to remember that most people do not develop dementia. So please don't lie awake at night worrying about this too much. So I'll stop there. Just to say that my role as a clinician scientist in my own research depends on public support in Canada and in the U.S., and I'm very grateful for that. I'll take your questions. Thanks.
As I'm sitting here getting demented, I look at the clinical trials that have been done, heart protection trials and others, and unfortunately, the randomized data is disappointingly negative. So your thoughts are to treat much earlier, but must be more to it than what you're just saying, these risk factors. I'm just wondering why so far you think the trials are negative, outside of the fact that we, you know, maybe if they have to go on for 10 years, which is a long time for a randomized trial.
Yeah. That's a good point. So that's the issue of an actual intervention trial where you're going to give a treatment and then see if it works rather than just observing treatments as they're happening in the wild. And that's completely true, that existing randomized trials have, in generally speaking, not been cognition hasn't been a primary endpoint. So it's been something that they've looked at the same time as some main endpoint, usually some cardiovascular heart attacks or something like that. There are issues when, especially in large trials, when they're designed by cardiologists in terms of how carefully they look at the brain issues, one. But two, I think it seems to be the case that if we're going to intervene, it's going to have to be quite a lot earlier than people had initially hoped, and that 3 years or 5 years isn't a long enough period of observation. The other possibility is that these associations are really just associations and not causal. But we do know that treating blood pressure, cholesterol, smoking is good for your cardiac health, if nothing else, and heart disease is even more common. So I guess because these kinds of recommendations are, we know, helpful for at least some conditions and possibly helpful for dementia, I think it's safe to stand and make them. But I agree it would be nice to have an intervention study with a positive result. Yeah.
And my second question, if I may, is if we're going to be treating for 10, 20 years in randomized trials, we need to find out the highest risk patients. So right now, how would you pick out those people? Or are there any testing that can be done that are before we get demented? Or are there any things we can be looking at saying, listen, I'm worried about you?
Yeah. There's been a lot of work trying to back up how early we can make the diagnosis. There's no way to make the diagnosis even in the clearly demented with complete assurance without a brain being able to examine the brain, autopsy or biopsy. But we can get pretty good with clinical assessment. And now people are getting better with imaging. So imaging, looking at rates of change, how much the brain is shrinking in specific areas, for example, and imaging the actual amyloid with PET imaging. And those look promising for being able to be to have a better sense of risk, if not certainty, about whether someone's going to have the dementia. And there's a lot of hope in the field in general that that's going to allow trials to really focus on the group that's most likely to show benefit.
Most of my question was actually answered there, thank you, except for what do you think of SPECT imaging for early detection?
Thank SPECT you. Imaging is a way to look at relatively, as these things go, relatively lower-tech way to look at brain perfusion or function rather than anatomy. And it's been used. It is clinically used. My own sort of clinical view of it is that it's probably useful in certain research settings, but that kind of in the general clinical practice, especially if it's being read by nuclear medicine specialists who are not necessarily focused on that aspect of SPECT, that generally it's way too unspecific to be helpful. It mostly causes anxiety without advancing the diagnostic direction.
Explain, please, the anxiety part.
Of the person, because they have an abnormal scan. But you can get abnormal scans with depression kind of at random, not necessarily meaning that there's definitely something wrong with the brain in a neurological way.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
So our last speaker for the afternoon is Dr. Wayne Sasa, who researches the biochemical changes that happen in the brain during the process of learning and committing information to memory. In particular, he's interested in the identification of the molecular memory traces that form the foundation of behavior. His lab investigates this problem in the relatively simple nervous system of the aplysia. And maybe you have a picture of an aplysia? Oh, good. Which is a large sea slug that you can't imagine remembers anything, but you'll see, whose behavioral memory is encoded in changes in the synaptic strength of certain neurons. This system allows researchers to visualize memory using modern imaging techniques and electrophysiology, and in doing so, they can directly examine the molecular basis of memory. Dr. Sasa.
Well, thank you all for coming today, and thank you for staying. So I'm going to talk really about what we know about memory at the molecular level, and I'll have a little story about how we can think about aging at that level. So when I think about memory, I'm a reductionist. I think about the simplest thing about memory that we can think of, and that is that memories happen at the connections between neurons, at synapses. And this is a very nice modeled picture of a synapse. The idea is that neurons are connected to each other. That's how your brain works, and it's at those connections that change when you actually make a memory. And there must be a physical event that occurs at those synapses that causes the change in synaptic strength that encodes memory. Every time you make a memory, there has to be a physical change in the brain. And not only a physical change, but a molecular change, because everything that happens inside your cells, like neurons, happens because of molecules. And the goal of my lab and the goal of my research is to try to understand what are those molecular changes, with the idea being that the better we understand that, the more we can learn about memories and how they're made. One thing is that there's not one answer. I mean, we'd like it if there was one unified principle, one magic molecule that we would find that explains all of memory formation, and that's not going to be true. Large numbers of things happen at your synapses when you make a memory, and there's multiple memory traces, and they have complicated serial and parallel relationships to each other. Some of them change first and then lead to other changes, and there are other ones that happen in parallel. So some forms of short-term memory happen in parallel with forms of long-term memory, and we have to understand them independently. But again, the more we understand about what those molecules are and how these changes happen, the more we can approach these kinds of questions. So in particular, you know, we do know some real molecular traces. That's not completely imaginary in our brain. We have found certain physical biochemical changes that are important for memory. One is the activation of a particular set of proteins called protein kinases. These are proteins that regulate other proteins. They put phosphates onto other proteins and change their function. And these are particularly important for memory formation. In fact, one way memory is retained is by persistently activating these protein kinases so that they're not just active for a short period of time. If they're active for a longer period of time, they can actually maintain the changes at your synapses. Another way that memories are made is to produce new proteins. It's a real fundamental difference between short-term forms of memory and long-term forms of memory, and that long-term forms of memory require the production of new proteins, while short-term forms of memory do not. At some point, memories, these things combine to make structural changes at your synapses. The synapses get bigger when memories are made, and understanding how that happens is a major focus of a lot of research. And at least in simple organisms, they make memories by making new synapses, so actually forming new synapses. And I still believe that that's a fundamental way of making very long-term memories, is to make new synapses between neurons. These different kinds of traces are different, and you can grade them in different ways. I like to grade them by a term called volatility, which means how easily they are to be reversed. So in other words, a short-term memory can be easily reversed by just removing the phosphate that was important for making it, by inactivating that kinase, and then the memory, that increase in synaptic strength will go away. Persistently activating the protein kinase will make it last longer, but it's interesting in memories that have been found to be maintained by persistent activation of protein kinases, you can still erase those memories by blocking that protein kinase even weeks or months after the memory were made. Maybe producing new proteins lasts for longer memories, but obviously the physical strengthening of synapses, physically making them bigger, is going to last for a longer period of time. It's a structure that's built that will last for longer. And again, new synapses. Synapses, people have looked in at least rodents at how long synapses can last, and they can last for the lifetime of a rodent for 2 or 3 years. Individual synapses have very long lifetimes. So how does this help us think about stress and aging and how they affect memory formation? Well, once we understand how the memory traces are made, it's a fairly simple thing to see, well, how, for example, does stress affect that? You're stressed, you release chemicals into your brain, glucocorticoids and other things, which actually impinge on the mechanisms of memory formation, either making some of them better and some of them worse. So we can look at that and we can predict how stress is going to affect memory formation. Aging is a little more difficult. Is aging just a nonspecific impairment, so everything just gets a little slower and a little bit worse, and so it's harder to make memories? Or are there actual switches that turn off memories? And I'm going to give you an example today from my own research where we found a switch where it seems that the animals actually make a change so that they no longer make a certain form of memory. And this animal is Aplysia. This is the organism I work on. It is a sea slug, and it is very, very stupid. And that's kind of the point, is that we want to work on an animal where we can really simplify memory to a large extent. These animals only have about 20,000 neurons, as opposed to your, I'm sure, trillion or maybe now a few hundred billion. But that's still a lot more than an aplysia has. And the point is, because they have such a small number of neurons, we can actually identify the synapses that change when the animal does make a memory. And we can study them at a very sophisticated level. And at least I believe that most of the mechanisms for synaptic change are going to be conserved over evolution. They do still make memories. The nervous system probably found ways to make memories at a very early stage in evolution and has probably retained most of those mechanisms as we get more and more neurons and therefore supposedly get smarter. So the behavior that you can actually study in an animal like aplysia is a behavior called sensitization. You all experience sensitization. You go see a very scary movie and you walk outside and someone touches you on the shoulder and you jump. And you wouldn't have jumped before the movie, so your behavior has changed. You become more sensitive. You sensitize. You have increased defensive reflexes. And aplysia has the same behavior. If it has a knock, horror movies don't bother aplysia, but if you give them a shock, if you give them a noxious stimulus, they respond by increasing their defensive reflexes, and this can happen over a short period of time with a single shock, or if you give them repeated shocks spaced in time, they will make a long-term memory for sensitization. And work mainly from the lab of Eric Kandel at Columbia University, who won a Nobel Prize in 2000, identified the synapses that change when those memories are made. So we can look specifically at individual synapses and see how they're changed. And the synapse that we look at is the one between the sensory neuron. So if you touch the aplysia, this is a neuron that responds to the touch. That neuron directly connects to the motor neuron that causes the reflex. So the connection between the sensory neuron and motor neuron is what changes. So we know that specific synapse changes, and we know how it changes, why it changes, what happens. The noxious stimulus causes the release of a neurotransmitter, in this case it's serotonin, and that serotonin is sufficient, necessary and sufficient, to cause that change in synaptic strengths. So that allows me now to study this in a very reduced system. I can actually take those neurons out of the animal, the sensory neuron and the motor neuron. This is a sensory neuron here and a motor neuron here. They're connected at synapses in my cultures, and I can add serotonin, and that synaptic strength will increase. And I want to understand how that happens. And I want to visualize it. I want to see memory occur, because by seeing it, I can study how it happens. So one way we see it is by actually looking at the activation of protein kinases. This green picture, this is actually a neuron, and the green is actually a protein kinase that is tagged with a fluorescent protein. When the protein kinase is active, it moves to the membrane. It moves from the middle of the cell to the edge of the cell, and that's how we know the kinase is active. And we can see this happen. If I click on this button, that's when we added serotonin, and you can see that we can watch that occur in live time. And we can do it under repetitive stimulation. We can see how it changes with repetition. We can see if it lasts a long time, if the kinase becomes persistently active. And we know that the activation of a kinase is necessary for memory, because if we block it, the memory doesn't happen. And we know the maintenance of memory is due to persistent activation of these protein kinases. So we can look to see, well, does aging affect that? And actually, one of my postdocs, Tyler Dunn, recently has found that this particular form of memory that's made by activation of this particular protein kinase actually goes away as the animal gets older. So this is an example of a neuron taken from a young animal before learning and after learning, and you can see that the green has moved to the edge. But in older animals, they don't do this. They don't move the kinase to their memory, and they don't form the memory. This is just a measure of memory formation comparing the younger animals to older animals. And I don't think of this as a deterioration
so much as almost a developmental change in the animal. It's gotten bigger. It's not as scared anymore of other things. It doesn't really need to sensitize as much. And these animals actually exhibit a change in their learning based on these molecular changes that are occurring inside their cells. So we want to identify exactly what happens. We know that the kinase doesn't get activated, but we don't understand why yet. So we're trying to figure that out. And we're also trying to see if we can find pharmacological agents that can make older animals do this and whether it will restore the memory or the ability to learn in those older animals. It's not that they lose their memory. It's they lose their ability to learn this behavior. Another thing we study in the lab is this ability to make new proteins. And we can actually use techniques to visualize that as well. And I was part of a recent study that was actually the first time that people were able to see proteins being made during memory. And this is looking very specifically at certain synapses. When the memories were induced, we could see these new proteins being formed specifically at the synapses, while other synapses that didn't receive the stimulus, in this case serotonin, did not show any change over time, suggesting that this is a really important mechanism for memory formation, that you send out the messages that encode for new proteins to your synapses, and then when you learn, you turn them into new proteins, which then function to increase synaptic strengths. And this is another important memory trace, and we haven't looked yet how this changes with aging yet, but it will be interesting to see. And to end, I just want to stress that because there are different memory traces, they're induced by different ways of learning. So protein synthesis, this mechanism, is only induced. It's not induced the first time the animal experiences the behavior or the first time you add serotonin to these cultures. You have to repeat it multiple times in a spaced manner in order to see this. So different memories require different memory traces. Molecular memory traces require different stimuli to induce them. In the other one that we looked at, the protein kinase, that's a short-term memory, and that we can see that with just one application of serotonin. So the induction of these traces is sensitive to the conditions of training. And, you know, we had a recent study where we looked at space versus mass training and found that space training was better for memory for various reasons, and I thought I'd just come back, since you were all McGill students, just remember the classes that you really studied for the night before. You crammed all that studying into 1 5-hour time. I bet you don't remember any of that now. But if you had actually studied like an hour every time, every day for about 3 weeks in this spaced way, you would have actually probably remembered it now. So this different training protocols actually does have real implications for real things. So I always tell my children, if you really want to learn this for life, you need to study it a lot over a long period of time. But if you really just want to know it for the exam, it's okay just to cram it the night before. So with that, I'll end and ask the questions.
I forgot my question. If you look at most retention rates from, if we remember 5 to 15% of what you said 3 months later, we've done good. And people talk about different levels and layers of learning. Musicians learn by song, chefs by smell. How to make memory stick? I mean, you can read things over and over again. That's certainly one way of doing it. But I'm curious, give us some other pointers of how do we teach our students and other learners to really, master retention. What have you learned from all this?
Two things. One is repetition is very good for memory. It does help. The other thing is a rich context. I mean, this has been shown in a number of ways in studies. The richer, the more connections that you have to the things that you learn, the more different ways that you can reach that memory, the better the memory is retained and the better you are at recovering it as well. So the more you know about something, the easier it is to learn new things about it. Well, if you're coming to something where everything is new, it's very hard to retain things. So the more connections you have to it, then the more different ways that you learn something, I think it's useful. But that can be hard because sometimes you are learning all stuff new, and then I think repetition is very good.
My question is really the opposite. I recently attended a lecture dealing with damage done by musicians who use bad habits or overpractice. And a neuroscientist explains that as a result of these actions, you are in a sense misprogramming your brain that keeps on acting in a dysfunctional way, and it's almost impossible to change. In other words, once you've done the damage over a long period of time, it's very difficult to erase that behavior. So I was wondering if you could perhaps deal with the fact that what can we, that particularly since as we get older, we keep doing many stupid things. So my question is, how can we manage to reprogram ourselves to break from old habits?
One of the big problems in memory research is it's true. Once you have made a really good memory or one way if you make good synaptic connections, it's an entrained behavior. It's very difficult to reduce it. And a lot of research is on about how to erase memories or how to weaken them or how to remove bad memories. And we're still struggling to do that. The stronger the memory is made, the harder it is to reverse. And maybe when we learn more about how these molecular traces are made, we'll find better ways of reversing them. But then we have to find some way of just reversing the bad ones and not the good ones, and that's going to be even harder.
Thanks, Wayne. Thanks. So you take a chair, and we'll have a general discussion. I'll tell you something I use. Because I have a lot of things to remember. So if I have, I'll take the time and I will make like a visual image, which I find works very well. So if I have a list, like I have to call my friend Dominic, I have to buy tulip bulbs, and I have to pay Metro Gas, I will imagine Dominic holding tulip bulbs and a check made out to Metro Gas. I'm quite serious. If you think about this, and mostly these things happen in the middle of the night, otherwise you'd have to get up and turn on the light and write it down with a pencil, you know. But if you visualize this, you'll remember it. If you take a little bit of time, and the problem, of course, is trying to forget it after you've remembered it, right? So that's a major problem. Any questions for the general panel? Yes.
Well, thank you. I found this afternoon very interesting. I would like to know an update. I like your model of the institute with the patients at the center. And from what I understand, at this point, the future model is that the patients will be distanced from the neurological institute. So,
sorry?
I thought the institute was expanding and there wasn't necessarily room for the patients.
Don't believe everything you think.
Okay. Well, is the neuro about to expand, and it does still continue to have
space? We're always
expanding.
We're always renewing and always expanding. Mm-hmm. We will always be together as an institute and a hospital, and at the moment we're on University Street. We're likely to stay on University Street. Mm-hmm. If there's a better option for expansion, we'll take it. Mm-hmm. But the neuro is a wildly successful, in part because of the way we've run it and the faculty runs it. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. I'm at the head, I'm the director, but mostly it runs itself. It runs well. And there's no reason under those circumstances to change the way it runs. So it has to be together, and we'll always expand because there's, you know, the problems of neurological disease, which we deal with much better now than we did in Penfield's day, by far. But these are problems which, as we get older and as you see, these diseases are very complex, and they're going to require a lot of attention. In a way, when I think about what would I really, at this point in my life, if I could go back
and pick a field, would I pick a field as hard as this? In the same way as Penfield said, you know, I would hate my profession if I knew it wasn't going to change. I mean, I think it's a much easier, in a way, job to study cancer than it is to study brain development and what happens to the brain as you, you know, you live your life. These are very difficult problems. So we have to stay close to our patients.
Okay, so what I've read in the Gazette that commentary by the doctors that they're concerned that they won't be able to just drop in their patients within a five-minute walk, that's not accurate.
Well, again, I mean, I think you have to, there's many physicians who are very, very happy, most of them are very, very happy working where we work at the Neuro and on University Street.
So that model will continue.
I certainly hope so. There's immense support, not only at the Neuro, but amongst our donors, our philanthropists, the foundations that support us. You know, we've gotten a lot of publicity recently because we're doing very, very well. And, you know, and it's one of the best things about Quebec. You know, I don't know why it works well, you know. I don't really. It's a cultural thing. And to tamper with it, people understand that if you tamper with it too much, you destroy it. You know, so don't believe everything in the Gazette. Anything else? Yes. Sorry.
Is the Montreal cognition test that we use out west and prefer, you know, in practice out there to the MMSC for quick studies in general practitioners' offices and in the hospitals, was it developed at McGill in the MNI? Do you know the Montreal cognition test? That's one question.
Yes. No, not specifically. It was trialed early at McGill, not at the MNI, though, in affiliation with the memory clinic at the Jewish General Hospital. Yeah.
Okay. So number two, like, would it be a sensitive enough test? So you were doing a prospective study, and it'd be interesting to hear if you're involved or thinking about being involved in a prospective study. Could it be a sensitive enough test to be used? So you used cut down as many variables as you could and, say, went with statins to try to, you know, solve the general vascular problems. Would it be a sensitive enough test to bring in prospectively, you think, or would you have to go to a more sensitive test? Or would you ever, is there anything in the works in that direction?
Sure. I mean, that general kind of bedside memory testing is the mainstay of diagnosis in most clinical situations. And it's clear that specific test is an improvement over the standard mini-mental test in that it's more sensitive, but that always brings the issue of whether it's picking up things that are, you know, it's oversensitive, so it has, anyway. The design of trials is a whole other issue in terms of how carefully you need to make the diagnosis, whether you want to be very sure about what the cause of memory loss is or not, whether you want to make sure you're only looking to prevent Alzheimer's disease, or you're just trying to improve cognition no matter what the underlying pathology is, that depending on what the question is. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yes?
I was wondering if anybody had taken a look at any possible relationship between the pharmacological treatment of clinical depression and memory loss.
Well, it's clear that depression untreated affects thinking and memory. It's also relatively newly recognized that depressive symptoms or symptoms that would fall into the category of depression can be features of early dementia of various kinds. So those two things alone make it a little hard to know whether specific treatments for depression might or might not be affecting memory, because you have the problem that you don't usually treat for depression unless you have depression. In general, though, the way we try to solve this problem in the clinic is if we suspect depression is playing a role in the person's symptoms, we start by treating the depression, because that is at least sometimes treatable. And you certainly can see improvement, but whether those drugs are potentially going to affect memory in a bad way depends, I guess, on the specifics of the situation. Yeah.
Thank you.
My question is primarily on migraine headaches. I know that you addressed primarily on dementia or memory, but can you give me a little bit of indication on your recent research on the effects of continual migraine headaches or in regards to that issue?
There has been, and I don't know what the Dr. Fellow would say, migraine has also been associated as one of the risk factors that could increase the incidence of Alzheimer's disease. It is not probably as well recognized as cardiovascular disease and vascular pathology, but it has also been. Now, is there whether migraine on a chronic, you know, chronic daily headache and chronic migraine would alter specific, you know, pathways in the brain? I don't think at that point that's known. I don't think migraine has any vascular pathology per se. There is no vascular pathology when you have migraine per se. But chronic migraine may be leading to dysfunction of pathways that may then be important in the development of memory circuitry. But that's not one of the strongest risk factors. It's really something, I think migraine on its own, I don't think it's a major risk factor for Alzheimer's disease.
Yes.
I must preface my question by the fact that I'm 85 years young. Around the house, I suddenly think of something I've got to put down on paper. I rush and find a pencil. I generally manage to make it. But if I have two or three thoughts to put on paper, by the time I get there, they're all gone. Is that normal?
Based on the audience response, I guess the answer is yes. It really is the case that there are changes of that sort. That's exactly the highest demand that uses a lot of the brain, keeping things in mind, especially in the face of distraction. And so that is the kind of thing that it tends to show wear and tear, particularly with normal aging.
I hope to make it to 85 years of age and still have a brain that works better than it is now. You look at the Einsteins in the world. What are different about their brains? We have all these functional foods out there. There's a whole industry saying that we can make people superhuman, super brain power. Then you hear things like, well, you know, alcohol destroys neurons. It's not good for the brain. Then the issue, you mentioned the cholesterol medications. There's case reports of, you know, psychosis on statins or the astronaut story about, and so how do you make sense of all this? And how do we all become Einsteins or make our kids Einsteins?
Wayne, you want to try that one?
Yeah, you know, we there's just a lot that we don't know. So, you know, you have to, what I would say is be very skeptical when people tell you something like, you know, this makes your brain much better because, or this food will make your brain much better because usually these things are not backed up by very strong scientific studies. And I would say for Einstein's brain, people have studied Einstein's brain a lot, and I'm still not convinced they found any differences, even though his brain was preserved and people have spent a lot of time studying it, trying to find out what the differences are. You know, I don't think that we are at that level where we can really know that. And we don't really know what you can do to make someone into a genius or creative. So you just try to, you know, follow the research. And if something really strong comes out, then you'll know, everyone will know about it.
You know, Einstein said that he had no special talents. It's a famous quote, that he just remained passionately curious. So there may be no obvious structural underpinning for, you could study, you know, Einstein's synapses forever and never learn a thing about what makes an Einstein. All I know is that the education system in every country that I've been in serves to suppress that curiosity past a certain age, right? And so a lot of your potential Einsteins may be just mentally squashed into becoming lawyers and MBAs. Because if they want to do art history, you know, what's the future in it, you know? And as my own mother used to say to me, Davy, she said, you like bugs, you like birds, go to medical school, you know? The surest way to kill curiosity. Anyway, yes.
You talked about use it or lose it and the importance of continuing to be active and thinking actively to keep your brain working. Are there situations where there's too much stimulation or too much high demand? Would that actually lead to a diminished functioning over time? Is there anything to watch out for?
The use it or lose it sort of line is more common sense than strong science. For sure, practice makes you better at anything. So if you want to get better at something specific and you do it repeatedly, you will definitely get better at any age. So that's one point. The question about whether you can overdo such things, it's the case that the brain has some kind of optimal performance depending on what you're specifically trying to do. So if you push things beyond that, you do get deterioration. So, for example, you know, you can remember two things to write them down, but if you're asked to remember five things while someone's talking to you about something else, you won't. You'll lose all of that information because you do kind of overload. But that relates to how memories are being kind of kept track of online rather than reflecting something that might harm your brain in some permanent way. So it would harm the process at that moment, but I don't think it would harm the functioning of the brain.
Trying to remember five things on a regular basis, or would you be hurting yourself by trying to do something like that?
I don't think it would hurt you. A question you might ask yourself is that something you actually want to spend your time doing? So if you really wanted to do that, then practicing it and, you know, using tricks to kind of get around the capacity limitations you might have, like visualization and so on, will improve your ability to do that. I don't think that it would harm your brain. It might harm your
I ask because I'm a simultaneous translator, and so we're functioning at many levels at the same time. And a lot of us are finding that we're feeling more and more stupid as we're going on.
That's really interesting. People who do work like that really loads on what's called working memory and the ability to shift between languages or taxi dispatchers, another category where people have to really hold things in mind and move fast. And they are, because you're working at a high demand kind of level, you're more likely to notice these minor decrements with age than most of people who are not usually asking quite so much of their brain in such a measurable way most of the time. So you're probably just more of a kind of canary in a coal mine of small age effects that are normal, but that are going to be more obvious to someone who's working at that level.
Last two questions.
I have a confession to make. I'm one of those squashed brains that went and did an MBA, but I'm working really hard to get over them. Probably will take me a little while to get there. And another confession is I'm one of those people, like the gentleman of 85. I just happen to be 46, who can't even remember as much as getting one thing on a piece of paper. So I'm actually working on that too, to see if I can get it better. But I was very interested to hear about the reversible effects of the compounds that you spoke about, Dr. Hamill. I believe you spoke about that. And that it has an effect on bringing back memory and, should I say, cutting the memory deficit. I think that's what you said to us. Correct me if I'm wrong.
The memory deficit once the animal were treated in that specific test. Yes.
Yeah. I wonder if there was a certain level of deterioration in the brain or in the blood vessels that you're referring to where that compound didn't have much of an effect on bringing back memory. But I wondered two other things, too. If it did really work well, when is it going to be commercialized or tested on human beings?
That's all interesting question. Let's see. We and others are working, looking to identify a molecule that will hopefully normalize memory in animal models of Alzheimer's disease in the hope that we can understand what's the target, why is this molecule active and not another molecule, for instance. As I said, it's been very easy to normalize vascular function in our hands and in the hands of others. Basically, every compound that has antioxidant, anti-inflammatory action was able to restore the vascular function. Most of these compounds were not normalizing the memory, though. The few compounds that were able to normalize memory appears to be acting at the level of clearing the amyloid beta. So basically that molecule that is accumulating or not cleared properly from the brain of the patient. So this is why this is one molecule that appears to do that. We really have to know if the other molecule that in our model or other people find that it's rescuing memory, memory is really acting through that pathway. Is that the most important pathway? So I think this is actively pursued by several people trying to understand why can we rescue memory with these compounds or other compounds that have nothing to do with the vasculature, because people are trying other molecules that do not necessarily act on the vasculature as well. But what was surprising is that there seems to be molecules because they have multiple effects, and we don't know exactly what is the critical effect for the vasculature. Maybe we know pretty well because they were developed for that. But in the brain, they may have additional effect. This is why we have to identify those first before we really go on and say this is the promising molecule. I think at that point it's very interesting, but we don't know enough for that.
Well, thank you all for coming. I want to thank our panel. We introduce Cynthia Price, who's the vice president of the McGill Alumni Association. Thank you very much.
I just want to take just a couple of minutes before we head out to the reception. I'm Cynthia Price. Thank you, Dr. Coleman, the vice president of the McGill Alumni Association. And I want to thank you all for participating in the Quox this afternoon. And a special thanks to our wonderful panel, Dr. Sosin, Dr. Fellows, Dr. Amel, and of course our wonderful moderator, Dr. Coleman. Thank you very much for joining us. I want to say that the neuro makes us all very, very proud, and it is fascinating to learn the kind of work taking place there today, which we can be sure will make history tomorrow. So on behalf of the Alumni Association, I've just got to look underneath here. I think, yep, we've got the infamous red bags. There we go. Thank you very much. There's never any delicate way of doing this as I disappear underneath the counter, but there we go. So thank you all so much. As you probably heard in one of the other quacks, they will be available on the McGill homecoming site in about a week, so you can relive this experience. And we look forward to seeing you again. And we have the reception going on just outside, so come on and join us. And enjoy the rest of the weekend. Thank you very much.